Protecting human rights is one of the core issues of the United Nations and is the mission of such agencies as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. Tracking human rights violations, however, can be difficult and dangerous. It often involves researchers traveling to conflict zones or countries in transition in order to document victim experiences and gather data. Increasingly, activists and researchers are turning to sophisticated technologies, including machine learning tools, in order to analyze human rights data. That's the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me in the studio are regular panelists, John Baylor, Chair of Miami Statistics Department, and Richard Campbell, Chair of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Megan Price. Price is the Executive Director of the Human Rights Data Analyst Group, or HRDAG, which is a nonprofit organization based in San Francisco. It works with human rights groups to figure out what questions can be answered with quantitative data or how such data can be used to help people better understand human rights issues. Thank you so much for being here today, Megan.
Thank you.
Can you just tell us, to begin the conversation, how Human Rights Data Analysis Group, or again, HRDAG, started?
Sure. It's a little bit of a long evolution, actually. The work started with my colleague and co-founder, Dr. Patrick Ball, in the early 1990s, when he discovered that the thing he had to offer some of the problems that he was seeing was his skill as a computer scientist. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he started this work formally at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And that was where he and his team first started using the name HRDAG. And then as they, over a few years, started to outgrow their very welcoming place there at the AAAS. They found a second home at another nonprofit that does technology for good here in California called mm-hmm. Benetech. Mm-hmm. And the team was incubated there at Benetech for ultimately 9 years. And so then it was just in 2013 that Patrick and I rolled out HRDAG as an independent organization, and that is the state we're in today.
So how did you get involved in human rights data analysis, Megan?
So I have a background in public health. My PhD is in biostatistics, and it was at public health school that I knew I wanted to do some kind of social justice work, and I started learning about human rights as a formalized field that could be studied and research conducted in this formal way. And it was through some of my courses there in graduate school that I learned about the work Patrick Ball was doing and that I learned about HRDAG. And I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time. Right around the time I was finishing my dissertation, HRDAG got a grant that enabled them to create a full-time position for a statistician. And I applied and never looked back.
So what are the kinds of things that you're doing there at HRDAG?
So the kinds of things that I personally am doing, my two main projects are focused right now in Guatemala and Syria. And each of those is a little bit different in terms of the data source and the methodological approach. So in Guatemala, there's a historic archive from the National Police, and it's literally this warehouse full of documents. And the challenge there was, how can we learn about the content of these documents as quickly as possible? And so we were asked to, well, when we were asked that question, we partnered with some volunteers from the American Statistical Association who helped us design a random sample of this very large, disorganized collection of documents. And so that's been one of my main projects, is analyzing that random sample and drawing inference about the content of that archive. And then one of my other main projects is working with documentation groups based in or from Syria who are recording the names of victims who've been killed in that ongoing conflict. And in that project, I'm primarily using the methods of what's called record linkage and what we call multiple systems estimation to essentially identify records of victims that have been reported to one or more of those sources, and then use that pattern of documentation to estimate the total number of people who've been killed in that conflict.
So Rosemary mentioned that work at the intersection of statistics and human rights can be dangerous. And you're talking about Syria here, and you're talking about countries that are in conflict. Can you talk about some of those? And I'm thinking about, you know, what happens when governments don't like the data?
Yes. Well, I would say by and large, most of the risk is taken on by our partners who we work with, mm-hmm. who do the actual collecting and storing and managing of the data. And that can very often be very risky for exactly the reason you just stated. Sometimes states in power are not happy about that particular data collection. Somewhat less frequently, they're not happy about our data analysis. Mm-hmm. But usually by the time a project gets to that stage, by the time we're trying to answer a quantitative question with statistical analysis, usually it's post-conflict and there's been some kind of a transition. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we do still have to deliver an answer that is unpopular, but there's usually some kind of infrastructure in place, or there's a different audience for that answer. It may not necessarily be getting delivered directly to the state in question. It may be getting delivered to the United Nations or to a truth commission or a local NGO.
Very good. Thank you.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. The topic today, using data to track and analyze human rights violations. I'm Rosemary Pennington. In the studio with me are Miami University Statistics Department Chair John Baylor and Media Journalism and Film Department Chair Richard Campbell. Our guest today is Megan Price, Executive Director of the Human Rights Data Analysis Group. Megan, I was watching a video in preparation for this, in which you mentioned the importance of sort of approaching this work from an interdisciplinary context. Why do you think it's important to do the work that you're doing, that it has to be interdisciplinary in nature, or should be?
Yeah, I think it absolutely has to be. And I think for me personally, that's why I became a statistician. I want to work on difficult and interesting problems. And the way that our analysis has meaning and can be useful is by collaborating with local field experts and also local substantive experts who can not only help us interpret the data that we're analyzing, but then help breathe life into the interpretation of the analyses once we've completed them. And I don't think any one of us alone can really do a sufficient job of telling the particular story of our work. I think we all have to collaborate together to identify the question that's most meaningful and most useful, and then to actually figure out what to do once we have the answer to that question.
So I'm curious, how do problems come to HRDAG? You know, who are the clients for HRDAG's work?
Yeah, it really varies. For the longest time, I used to say, and this is still true, my colleague Patrick Ball is quite well known in this field, and it was sort of a joke, but it is true that sooner or later, for anyone who was working on human rights violations or in a post-conflict area who had a little bit of data or who was thinking about data, someone would eventually say to them, you know, you should really call Patrick. And to a certain extent, that's still how projects come to us, is that folks know us and know our work and will suggest that someone reach out to us. But sometimes also so I think of that as sort of a push, folks who come to us. Sometimes it's also a pull. Sometimes we'll read a news story or be aware of a certain situation that we care deeply about and feel like our particular skill set could provide some added value. And so then we'll start reaching out to our various partners and contacts at advocacy organizations and start asking, hey, is anybody collecting data about this? Is anybody thinking about doing an analysis? Is there some role that we could play?
So could you clarify that for Guatemala and Syria?
Sure. So in the case of Syria, the UN, the United Nations approached us in early 2012 because they found themselves in this unique to them situation where they couldn't safely get people on the ground to conduct investigations and to collect their own data. And they were aware of these other organizations that were collecting information. But there were multiple of those organizations, and the United Nations didn't really know what to do with those multiple sources of information and kind of how to integrate them into a whole. And so that was really the way the problem was presented to us, was we have these lists, what should we do? And we kind of said, that is exactly our wheelhouse. Let us help. And in the case of Guatemala, Patrick had been working in Guatemala for years at the point that the archive was discovered in 2005, and we were invited to come work with them a year later. And so many of the folks involved with the National Police Archive were aware of Patrick and H.R. Dagg and our work. And so they reached out to him for help in trying to figure out what was the best way to make sense of this massive amount of data.
I suspect that a big part of your work is trying to explain to audiences, whether they're government, whether they're journalists, who don't understand what it is you do or don't understand statistics and data. So talk about some of the challenges of trying to explain to a more general audience the work that you do and your findings.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. That is both one of the hardest parts and one of my favorite parts of my job. And I think in my case, the training that I got teaching Stats 101 to public health grad students is really what prepared me for that and what made me really love it. Because I think that explaining this work to folks who might come to these conversations with preconceived ideas about statistics being intimidating or hard to understand or boring, I just love winning those people over. but I would say that you're absolutely right, and that it's been interesting to watch the evolution of data journalism, because I think that these days journalists are some of our most receptive audience members, and they often do really have the patience to hang in there with us and listen to all of our caveats and to publish an interval rather than a single number. Not always, but we're finding a lot more success with that. And then I would say another challenging audience that we've really learned better how to communicate with is when we're explaining in a courtroom the kind of analysis that we've done to judges and to lawyers. That is very challenging, because a courtroom wants a very, very narrow, very specific set of facts. Mm-hmm. And so that's right. Really how we've learned to narrow our analysis down to the specific question at hand.
So when you're explaining this, there's always going to be some kind of uncertainty or variability in these estimates. How do you communicate this in a way that people don't say, well, there's so much variability, I mean, we can't say anything? How do you combat that in telling these very important stories?
Yeah, that to a certain extent is the million-dollar question. And unfortunately, sometimes that is our answer. Our answer is we really don't know. And I think that's one of the most frustrating times, is when there's so much uncertainty that to tell the truth and to be transparent about what we know, we have to say we don't know. But in other cases, I would say that when people reflect back to us, well, there's so much noise, or we just can't draw this conclusion, we really do push back and try and say, well, but if you look at this distribution, or if you look at this interval, we can show that they're non-overlapping, or we can show that there's a statistically significant difference between, you know, this relative risk and that relative risk. And we do, in those cases, tend to rely on some statistical jargon to try and emphasize the point that no, these, we can draw some conclusions. And what the uncertainty is enabling is us to identify when we can say that there's a difference and when we can't.
Sure. That sounds critical. That's the challenge for this. And being honest about the uncertainty is part of the credibility of the work that you do, I'm sure.
You mentioned before too about some of the some of the ways that you have to translate this to journalists for them to understand. Can you talk a little bit about mistakes that you see journalists make that are frequent or things that they might do better?
Yeah, one of my own personal pet peeves, and unfortunately I don't have sort of a good solution to it, is maps. I understand that maps are very compelling. They're very interesting. As soon as we have any sort of geographic information, we want to put it on a map to tell a story, to convey what's happening. But very frequently when you draw a map and you put, you know, shading or circles or what have you on a map, there are blank spots. And I always want to know, is that spot on the map blank? Because in fact, whatever it is that you're measuring didn't happen there. So there was no violence there, or there was no drug use there, or whatever. Or is it blank because you just don't know about that region, because you didn't have access to it, or because it's mountains and nobody lives there? And I think it's really hard to figure out how to explicitly convey that difference with the visual presentation of a map, because all of us, we want to see those patterns, and our eyes are drawn to, clearly there's a problem here and it looks okay over there. And so I don't have a good solution to that other than using fewer maps, which is not a good solution. but that's one of the things that my eye always tends to get drawn to is thinking about, well, what did that data really look like at the beginning?
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking about data and human rights. So what advice would you give, Megan, to journalists who are, hoping to report or trying to report on some of the data that your group is producing? Well, what advice would you give them to sort of suss out what the story is in the data?
That's a great question. I guess the advice that I would give is, it's not really advice. It's more of a wish. I would wish for journalists to have the lead time to ask a lot of questions, and then the print space to tell a more complicated and nuanced story. And I think that one of the things that's hardest is that I think those are the stories journalists want to tell. And I think that unfortunately, sometimes they are on a tight deadline and they just need a soundbite, and they just have a headline and a little blurb, and they, you know, they don't have the space or the patience for the five caveats that I'm going to give them.
Right. I think journalists would also like that space too.
Absolutely.
You know, in your article that you wrote in Significance magazine a while back, you had mentioned kind of the idea of document dynamics versus conflict dynamics. And that was I had not thought about dynamics being modified by either of those words. So could you talk a little bit about what does that mean to talk about document dynamics and conflict dynamics?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we think about, and by think I mostly mean worry about the most on our team, is what about, because we're primarily studying conflict, what is it about the conflict itself that is affecting our ability to measure the violence that we're trying to measure? And so specifically, when I talk about conflict dynamics and documentation dynamics, what we see over and over again are these cases where the violence increases and the security situation worsens, and yet reports of violence decrease, specifically because it becomes impossible to do that documentation work. It's too unsafe. And in no way is that a criticism of the groups who are doing this incredibly important and difficult work. It's just reality. It's just what happens during a conflict. And so if all we're doing is relying on what we're able to see and record at some of the most crucial instances of a conflict, we may get exactly the wrong idea because we haven't made use of our statistical tools to estimate what we don't know.
Cool. That's what a hard problem.
It's a hard problem, but, you know, statistics is sort of built for it. We just have to use our tools. Mm-hmm.
How much is the, you know, we talk a lot, especially those of us who teach journalism, about the whole distrust or that comes, I think, partly from the polarization, the fake news movement, the distrust of science, the distrust of data. How has this changed the way you think about what you do and what you actually do? And how often does this come to play in your everyday life?
Yeah, I don't know that fake news specifically has had a big impact on our work, but something that I think of as being related to that is this paradoxical reaction that we see people having to data and graphs and visualizations and this kind of thing, is that they both think they must be true, whatever they are, and sort of accept them unquestioningly and don't have any skepticism and just, you know, assume that that is the story. And also don't really have a lot of understanding of how the data were collected and have very often have this sort of, I hated statistics class and I don't want to kind of dig deeply into what that means. And I'm a little intimidated and a little, I feel negatively about like the way that's being used. And so that's often one of the challenges that we have to figure out how to walk, where we know that a quantitative result is going to be given a lot of weight in terms of evidence. Mm-hmm. But that we also have to give our audience the tools to evaluate whether or not that weight is appropriate.
This brings me to a question that I've been thinking a lot about, especially in relation to the talk I mentioned earlier. You brought up, I think, towards the end of that short little talk, the idea of bias in data and how with the tools that we have available, sometimes we can lose sight of the fact that sometimes data can be biased and that we can import those biases into our analyses. So how would you suggest researchers or people who are doing analysis on maybe data sets that are touchy or like the police brutality stuff that you talked about a little earlier or human rights violations? How can we as researchers think about bias and sort of mitigate bias as we sort of import the data and analyze it?
Mm-hmm. I think it always has to come back to the data. And I think we always have to ask ourselves, how is this data collected and how is it generated? Mm. And those may or may not be the same thing. And related to those questions, what's missing from this data? And I think actually police data is a really good example to use because it has been in the news a lot more, and I think folks are starting to get a lot more skeptical about the way that data is collected and what it really can tell us. Because if you think about arrest data, on the one hand, hopefully, it accurately represents a complete picture of the arrests that police have conducted. Mm-hmm. But an arrest is not synonymous with a crime.
Yeah.
Because some crimes lead to an arrest and some crimes don't. And whether or not that crime leads to an arrest is a very complicated process related to what the crime is, the characteristics of the person who perpetrated it, the characteristics of the police force in that area and their relationship to that community, and the local laws and policies in that community. And so that's a lot less clear when what you're looking at is just a count of arrests. And it's kind of hard to necessarily untangle all of the processes that led to the data that you observe.
So one thing we often ask guests when they come on the Stats and Stories is about what students might do to prepare to do the kind of work that you do. So what kind of advice, what kind of guidance might you give them?
Well, this is my own bias as someone with 3 degrees in statistics, but take some statistics classes.
No argument here, Megan.
Right. I do think that that is the best place to be pushed to think hard about where your data come from and how they were generated. Take some programming classes. I did not take enough in grad school. I did a lot of my programming learning on the fly, on the job. And I think I would have been a lot better off taking some programming classes. And then I would also say, you know, to whatever extent you can within your program, design a curriculum of electives that you're excited about. Think about the kinds of problems that you want to tackle and then go take those classes. And maybe they're journalism classes, maybe they're law classes, maybe they are public health classes, maybe they're economics classes. But you know, really branch out, and school is the time to take some of those risks and to go sit in on something that just sounds interesting, even if it maybe doesn't seem like it's directly on your career path.
So talk about writing there. I've read some of your essays. You're a very good writer. So where did you learn how to do that? How did that get folded into all the statistics classes you've taken over the years?
Well, I was a journalism minor in undergrad.
Oh, boy.
There you go.
These guys are going to be tough to live with now, Megan.
That explains a lot.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay.
I have to also give some credit to my mother, who is also a journalist and a copy editor, and my college roommate, who is an English major, and she read everything I wrote. And to this day, when I proofread things, I can still see her writing in the margin, so with the big question mark. I haven't made my point yet.
All right. Well, Megan, thank you so much.
Well, thank you guys. This was a lot of fun.
Indeed.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter or iTunes. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.